You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, July 8th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Friedlander, journalist and author of The AOC Generation, How Millennials Are Seizing Power and Rewriting the Rules of American Politics, joins us to look at the state of the left within the context of AOC, her run, and Eric Adams' victory in the New York City Democratic mayoral primary. Meanwhile, rescue efforts in the Surfside, Florida condo collapse have ended, transitioning to a recovery operation, devastating, for the families of the deceased and missing, 54 officially declared dead, and 86 people unaccounted for. All fans have been barred from attending the Tokyo Olympics amid a COVID surge and subsequent protests. Four people suspected of assassinating Haiti's President Moïse have been killed and two arrested after a firefight with police. No word yet on who the suspects are. Meanwhile, disturbing details emerge out of a facility for thousands of migrant children in Fort Bliss, Texas, including lack of clean clothing and bedding, lack of medical care, and the use of a bullhorn or blasting music to wake up kids in the morning. Yes, this is under President Biden, folks. Dozens of House Democrats have signed on to an expansion of Medicare's coverage, including dental, vision, and hearing, which they want included in the reconciliation package. The U.S. is giving the U.K. assurance that they will not house Julian Assange in a supermax prison if extradited, trying to entice the U.K. into handing Assange over. Not good news. And lastly, former South African President Jacob Zuma was taken into custody to begin serving his 15-month prison sentence yesterday, found guilty of contempt in a corruption investigation. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen and everyone in between. I am here for Sam Steeder. He is out today, but we have got a great show for you. You won't miss him too much, I promise you. Let's start with the typical Fox News ridiculousness. So as the Delta variant spreads, the Biden campaign is announcing a new initiative to go door to door with a vaccination campaign. They're going to go to places of worship and essentially offer up vaccinations. I don't know how effective this is going to be, but something has to be done because only 20 states, I believe, thus far have reached the 70% vaccination threshold, and the Delta variant is two times more contagious than the original variant of COVID, and it's really starting to run rampant over many parts of the country. But Fox continues to have quite the freak out. Here is Charlie Kirk on Tucker Carlson's program last night. He's continuing to be Fox's resident young person even as he ages. I'm sure he pretends not to. He cosplays as a college student, or at least tries to appear like their buddy. So here he is pledging solidarity with his fellow college students who may be compelled to be vaccinated.
But more than anything else, Tucker, what we are going to do is a massive public relations campaign and make sure students know they are not alone. They don't have to hide in the shadows. That's all right. Of a sudden, they're concerned that if they get the vaccine, they're going to be treated as if there's something. I said this earlier, and this is a big statement, but it's almost this apartheid style open air hostage situation. Like, oh, you can have your freedom back if you get the jab. This is unacceptable. We're going to fight back against it.
He almost said open air prison there. Open air hostage.
What was the if to apartheid? If you do this, you can have your freedom.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, if you become white, right? Like if you change your skin color, it might not be entirely analogous, Charlie. Perhaps time to finish your degree at your college, right? Here's another prong of the arguments, though, being leveled at Fox News. So we have the, oh, it's discrimination on one side. Very, within the vein of the Marjorie Taylor Greene accusation that this was similar to Jews' treatment in the Holocaust, which was understandably met with a ton of outrage, as should these apartheid comments, although luckily Charlie Kirk is not a member of the House of Representatives. But Brian Kilmeade is representing on Fox and Friends the other way that conservatives are trying to attack this issue.
Meanwhile, 7 minutes after the top of the hour, one of the big stories, been with us for the last 2 years, is COVID-19. The origin is the top story, but the focus of this administration on vaccination is mind-boggling. Listen, in many cases, they've done a very good job getting the word out and getting the vaccine out, from Johnson & Johnson to Pfizer to Moderna. They're available if you want them, but that's not enough. Now you need to be berated by none other than Dr. Fauci because you're playing politics. That's the reason you may have not gotten it.
Playing public health.
This is not complicated. We're not asking anybody to make any political statement one way or another. We're saying try and save your life and that of your family and that of the community.
Yeah, I mean, that's hard for someone like Brian Kilmeade to understand, because for him and for other members of the right or people that watch Fox News, the majority of their politics is revolving around, how can I own the libs in this way? How can I essentially buck social trends that I find offensive to my way of life because it wasn't exactly how I saw the world when I was 13 or whatever, when I was a kid. I mean, that's so much of what this is just reactionary politics and also attempting to flip off the left, right, and make sure that they express their acrimony for cultural shifts. But here is the reality of the Delta variant, because this isn't some game. This isn't, you know, just a way to say I'm not going to participate in what the government is telling me to do, what Joe Biden is telling me to do. There are real consequences, obviously, to not getting vaccinated. And we're seeing them in Missouri, which is one of the states that has the lowest vaccination rates. And the Delta variant is, I think, around 80% of what they're seeing in terms of cases there.
Savannah, what do Springfield hospitals need most right now?
Yeah, Joe and Gina, the surge in cases has created a large demand for ventilators. Now, here at the University of Kansas Hospital, they say that they haven't sent any ventilators yet, but they may have to soon. They say typically the process goes that Mercy Spring Hospital in Springfield, they would be calling on the state of Missouri for relief first, because Mercy Hospital in Springfield ran out of ventilators as of this weekend, and they're working to get some supplies from their sister hospitals in Northwest Arkansas and in St. Louis. Mercy's also asking for any available travel nurses or physicians to relieve some of their exhausted staff members. They predict the only way this surge will slow down is if more people get vaccinated.
Can't stop talking about it. We've got to keep influencing the community because it's the only thing. You look around, this is unique. The other places around the country don't have COVID. It's just not there.
Well, I mean, it's certainly not there to the extent that we're seeing in states like Missouri, states like Kansas, like Iowa, who are being hit hard right now. I mean, they are still in the beginning of the pandemic there. The fact that in the summer months when when COVID is not as likely to spread, we're seeing that kind of surge, a shortage of ventilators and beds, that should be chilling to anybody that lives there and anybody who has loved ones and anybody who wants to move past this. And it's purely because of efforts like we're seeing on Fox News to downplay the necessity for vaccines. And vaccine hesitancy you can draw a direct line to the increase in hospitalizations and crises in states.
It also sets the table for a worse variant to possibly even emerge from this one. Like, the more we let this gallop around out of, lackadaisicalness or whatever, the more it has a chance to mutate into a way that maybe it starts affecting children, and then maybe we might take it seriously.
I wouldn't even hold my breath on that, because their obsession with, you know, cultural fealty or their resistance to this, it's being effectively weaponized by people like Tucker Carlson, who saw that this was a constituency that he could tap into, and it's Unfortunately, like a lot of propaganda campaigns, Fox wages, and this goes deeper than Fox, but they've multiplied it. It's effective. So please, if you haven't gotten vaccinated yet, please do. So there isn't an even worse variant than the Delta variant that we're seeing, as Matt said. We are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, David Friedlander will be joining us to talk about the progressive movement.
Thank you, Emma. Folks, today's show is sponsored by one of my favorite sponsors, Sunset Lake. They make great CBD products. You can find them at sunsetlakecbd.com. What do they have? They have gummy bears. They have tinctures, which have been a huge boon to my sleep. They have smokables. They have pre-rolls. They have smalls. They have fudge and coffee, all with CBD that is grown with a tremendous amount of integrity and is tested by third party. So you can find exactly what the contents of what you are ingesting are. They also have fantastic business practices. $15 minimum wage at the company. It is mostly employee owned. They use integrated pest management. That means no pesticides. They use 100% organic fertilizer. They work with the University of Vermont in terms of their agricultural practices. And they are real movement partners. They've been really helpful in calling attention to and financially supporting the nurses who have been on strike in Worcester at St. Vincent's Hospital for well over 100 days now. They've been helping in their community. Just a great bunch of folks who make a great product that has the salve. And why do I say that? Well, because I'm looking at my hand. It has arnica in it. And in the summer, longtime listeners will know, and maybe this is too much information, but sue me. I get eczema on my hands, and it is incredibly painful. Makes it difficult to go to sleep. The only thing that I've ever taken that has helped has been like prednisone, but I don't want to take that on any type of regular basis. And I have gotten a tremendous amount of relief from the Arnica CBD Salve that is ostensibly for your muscles, but I put it on at night and I can go to sleep. And I think it helps long term too. But nevertheless, all sorts of products. They have skin lotion. Check it out, sunsetlakecbd.com. Go there and use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, one word. They're fans of the show. LEFTISBEST, one word, and you get 20% off. Check it out now. Back to Emma.
We are back. Thank you, Sam. We'd like to welcome to the program David Friedlander. Do we have David? Okay. We'll hold off on welcoming him. There he is. I'd like to welcome to the program David Friedlander, journalist and author of The AOC Generation, How Millennials Are Seizing Power and Rewriting the Rules of American Politics. David, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Great. So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So full disclosure, I should say that I am interviewed in your book. I didn't mention that David, I spoke with him a little bit for the Peacock show, which everyone should check out there if you haven't already, Majority Report listeners. We do an extra hour, Sam and I, interviewing some really interesting reporters. And we talked a little bit about the Eric Adams candidacy, which I want to get to in a bit. But first of all, I should say your book is really excellent. It's a great encapsulation of, the leftist surge that swelled from Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign, and it largely focuses on, as the title suggests, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as just a bit of a ballast for the progressive movement. Let's start with what motivated you to write this book, besides obviously interviewing me.
That was the first. That was the first reason. You and I got to get coffee together, and everything else sort of flowed from there. No, but, I mean, Ocasio-Cortez, when she was elected, I'm in her district. And when she was elected in 2018, it was like, it was such a phenomenon. I mean, one that the world had kind of seemingly never seen before, at least that I've witnessed. I mean, similar to Barack Obama or Donald Trump, where she just, this woman won a congressional seat and then the sort of just seemed to have the world in the palm of her hand. And so I think it was sort of worth it to kind of figure out like how we got to this moment and what it all meant. And that was the real sort of motivation for it, and having a sort of front row seat for it, you know, living here in Queens, in her district, and interviewing her as she was campaigning. Not quite as extensively as you did, but a bit at least.
Right. And I mean, I the book really dives deep into her background as a person in her early experiences, which I just found, you know, interesting, that stuff I didn't know before. How did her, I guess, personal experiences through college or just the era that she grew up in, you know, inform your characterization of this new progressive swell as the AOC generation? Because obviously there are a bunch of things. She graduated in the wake of the Great Recession. She experienced political disillusionment with the Obama administration. Also her experiences in the service industry, trying to work in the wake of the Great Recession, which is obviously much maligned by Tucker Carlson, working class hero. So, I mean, how much of that kind of informed your larger extrapolation of what this movement meant?
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, I think one of the reasons she sort of became a superstar in a way is because she kind of symbolized for a lot of people like this rising generation, and that they were going to rewrite American politics, American political life, American life in general. And that her election sort of meant that, like, oh, here they are. They've now, you know, arrived onto the scene. And, you know, that generation, which is not mine, to be clear. I mean, she graduated from college in, I think, 2011, right when the sort of, you know, still in the midst of the recession, she had taken a bus home in the middle of college to vote for Barack Obama. And then, you know, kind of grew disillusioned with him in a lot of ways, but moved to New York, as many people do after college, after, especially in her case, attending like a fairly elite college in Boston University. And then had tried to kind of, you know, make it in the world. Just got into sort of startups, started publishing, this kind of thing. In that economy, you know, nothing was really taking with her. And also, you know, her father had died when she was a college, I think, sophomore. And so she felt the need to make money. And so she ended up getting into the service industry. And, you know, she's sort of and working at a restaurant in the Union Square neighborhood in Manhattan and tending bar and that kind of thing. I actually since talked to people who sort of remember her as a bartender kind of thing. And, you know, I think she had sort of reached a point in her life, and she sort of said as much, where it just seemed like she was kind of stuck in a rut and not really sure how to get out of it. And all of the sort of hopes that she had for herself were kind of not arriving in a way.
Right. And I mean, I think that's, as I say, indicative of larger generational trends. And then, of course, there's the Bernie Sanders campaign, Standing Rock, where she was at. I was there, too. Flint, Michigan, these kinds of massive social movements that I think captured people in a way that, I mean, you write about how a lot of protest and political action and energy that existed, say, in the 1960s was just, it slowly died like a battery, right? I mean, we saw anti-apartheid protests and things of that nature. But as neoliberal politics emerged, there was a complete sapping of progressive energy. So I'm just wondering if you could contextualize some of those, you know, those two, Standing Rock, Flint, those two big movements in, I guess, the larger political progressive space.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the sort of interesting things I think about AOC is that her story kind of like tracks the story of the American left in the kind of like pre and post-Trump era, however you want to characterize it. And so she kind of hit all of these sort of Stations of the Cross in her own development in a way, and kind of, you know, went through them as she was both, like, before she was a candidate, as a young person working for Bernie, and then later, you know, running for office, kind of thing. And so what happened in her particular case was that, you know, she got really involved in the Bernie Sanders campaign. That was really her first kind of political organizing experience. I wouldn't even say she got really involved. I mean, she got involved. She was like a kind of low level canvasser. And then after Trump won, you know, Trump was such a shock to the system. And I think it's really like one of the kind of undercurrents of my book is like it was just like this shock to everybody when Donald Trump won, and everyone was sort of figuring out what to do next. And if you think about like just in the days and weeks after that, you had like, you know, groups like Indivisible Form, and people started getting together in living rooms and churches and sort of figuring out what to do next. And Ocasio-Cortez and some of her friends went on a road trip. It was freezing cold, you know, in the middle of December and January. And they drove to Flint, Michigan, and they actually like talked to some of the people that were engaged in some of the work there. And then they went to Standing Rock and they did the same there. And it was on her way kind of coming back from Standing Rock that a group called Brand New Congress reached out to her and talked to her about being a candidate for Congress. And, you know, I just to sort of touch on something you also mentioned is that I think the sort of story of Ocasio-Cortez and the story I tell in the book in a way is the story of a American left that's kind of finally realizing that they need to get engaged in the political space and that they need to win power. And that is really her story. And that these kind of like various amorphous marches and, you know, whatever, petition drives and Facebook check-ins, they kind of don't count for much in terms of like improving people's lives unless you can achieve power.
Right. And I mean, there's, you talk about Facebook groups, then there's organizing, which helps achieve power. So it's not, you know, just power for power's sake. It's like taking that kind of activist mentality and then actualizing it, for lack of a better word. Talking about achieving power, I think, you know, so much of what's great about your book is you can look at these larger dynamics through this lens. You know, her race versus Crowley, she was up against an immensely powerful political machine in New York, which was buttressed by an immensely powerful Democratic Party and fundraising apparatus on a national stage, which is so fascinating too. You know, she did have a bit of it was a two-headed monster in that way, because Crowley had the complete fealty of the New York political machine, which is what I want to transition to once we kind of go over this about Eric Adams and what that means. Talk about that race and what that meant in terms of, one, gaining power, right? But two, knocking down power and powerful institutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that like, you know, people I talked to in the book, talked to me about like how the left had kind of been afraid of power in a way. Politics is sort of seen as grubby, right? And it's, you know, you got to make compromises. And then, you know, power is like a kind of almost like a dirty word for many leftists. And so they needed to kind of sort of reorient their thinking in order to get engaged in congressional races in order to win them. And then, you know, and a candidate like Ocasio-Cortez, I mean, she kind of was able to sort of harness all of this leftist energy from groups like Justice Democrats, like Brand New Congress, who I mentioned earlier, Democratic Socialists of America, who got pretty involved in her race, and also by, you know, going on left-leaning media programs like the Young Turks and places like that. And, you know, it was like, and I should also say, you know, here in New York, there was a movement afoot in post-Trump. It's kind of a little complicated, but if you just bear with me, there were this group in the state legislature, the state Senate in particular, who are these elected Democrats who are caucusing with Republicans. And it had been going on for a few years. I've covered Albany a lot. No one really cared about it in the way that most people don't care about like state legislative politics. But after Trump won, all of a sudden everyone woke up and was outraged by this. The local legislator in the district that Ocasio-Cortez ran in ended up becoming one of these lawmakers who sort of left the Democratic caucus to join the Republicans.
The IDC. Keep going.
Yeah. So everyone at the IDC, they're called the Independent Democratic Committee Caucus, something like that. And everyone's just sort of outraged by this once they woke up to it. And so she kind of rode that energy in a way to beating Joe Crowley. And the old kind of machine politics of New York had never seen anything like this coming.
Yeah, I mean, so you're talking about the old machine there. I want to get to that again with Eric Adams, because we just got the news that he's going to be the Democratic nominee and very likely the new mayor. But, you know, just in terms of the national stage, what's your opinion on how the, you know, old generation does seem to be clinging to power? You know, I don't even want to say old generation, but yes, the old generation. And how is there going to be a shift there? What has to give for somebody like Ocasio-Cortez and newer, you know, Justice Democrats, brand new Congress folks to take power there? Because despite the significance of this race in terms of looking at the American left, there's a lot of obstacles that are still in the way of kind of a progressive takeover in Congress.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously the biggest one is to sort of win seats. And some of the people that were behind Ocasio-Cortez's run, this group called Justice Democrats, who are often sort of called the kind of Tea Party of the left. But I think they're actually a lot savvier than that, because they only tend to run in these safe urban districts that are very diverse. And they're represented by kind of older, mostly white, but certainly moderate lawmakers. And they focused on those and thinking that if you just can like win a handful of those, you can kind of remake the Congress. And they've certainly done that. I mean, now the Justice Dems, it's like, I think they're called, it's sort of like the squad writ large, but they're like a decently sized political force. I mean, there's maybe 9 or so of them, which isn't bad in a 215 person body. And so that's the first thing. I mean, I think that the kind of way in which American politics is set up right now and probably for the future is going to limit their power when it comes to kind of that negotiating bills and leverage and all this stuff, just because my read on it is it always seems like the moderates have this advantage where you can't, like, the left wing of the party is not going to walk away from half a loaf if it means getting half of the population Medicare, it means half of an infrastructure bill, if it means like half of a child allowance kind of thing. And so they kind of don't have leverage in that sense. What they do have leverage in, and what makes Ocasio-Cortez so effective, particularly for someone who is just a second-term lawmaker, is that you control this sort of national media spotlight, and you control the media narrative, you know, and they can, I mean, Ocasio-Cortez in her first year in office was on like RuPaul's Drag Race, right? So they're the ones who can kind of like, I think in general, sort of frame and shape the debate, even if they don't have a lot of influence on how the actual sausage then gets made.
Because then when the sausage gets made, you have Hakeem Jeffries, who has taken over Crowley's old leadership position, who is starting a super PAC to combat the Justice Democrats.
Right.
I mean, there is the old guard, right, where, of course, it's obviously Steny Hoyer, Pelosi. They're older in age and also part of the old guard. But then you have ideological equivalents like Hakeem Jeffries coming up, who are going to take that mantle whenever Pelosi or Hoyer retire. I mean, how do you combat that?
I mean, I think that's difficult, because I think that, you know, one thing we've seen is that communities of color, and we'll get into this when we talk about the mayor's race in here in New York, perhaps, have not been as amenable to that kind of messaging from the Justice Dems, from some of the left-leaning aspects of the party. And we're seeing this kind of divide where, you know, whiter but still diverse neighborhoods and districts end up electing these kind of, you know, very left-leaning lawmakers. And then, you know, mostly communities of color end up electing mostly moderate lawmakers. And so I think something kind of will have to crack that apart, and it's hard to see precisely what that is right now.
So then that's a great transition to the victory of Eric Adams, which Democrats on the national stage, or him himself, have declared as he said he was with the new face of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. We did an extensive interview on Peacock about this, but I want to kind of go over the same territory here just for the Majority Report regular audience. Who this guy is, he ran as a centrist and seems to be a part of the same machine that Ocasio-Cortez and others, including, you know, getting rid of the IDC, they've helped defeat. But he's a unique character in many ways with a unique set of problems, including a Trumpian kind of a propensity to lie, potentially there's some legal iffiness when it comes to some of the properties that he owns and rents out. Let's just start with his origins as a politician and kind of how that fits into this narrative of a progressive upswing in New York and nationally as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's someone who's a little bit hard, I think, to put into a box in a way. But he is definitely presenting himself as a kind of answer to some of this progressive left-wing energy and saying, you know, essentially stop, and it was wrong. And that what Democratic primary voters want is someone like him, who is, on the one hand, you know, tough on crime, pro-charter school, but also pro-labor union, and does focus on, I think, the material needs of poor and disenfranchised communities. All that said, he's a former police officer. That's where he got his start, really, in the sort of civic life of the city. And he very quickly became a kind of outspoken reformer within the police department. But in this way, he was, on the one hand, calling for police to be more mindful of the way they treat the communities they police, but also for those communities to be more respectful of the police. A lot of police officers who served with him really disliked him and thought he was kind of a showboat and a show off. He was a Republican in the mid 90s. He was also a supporter of Louis Farrakhan. He flew to Indiana to accompany Mike Tyson when he was released from prison. Something that got him into trouble with the police department because it was seen as associating with a known felon. Which is sort of against police department regulations. He ended up running for the state Senate as a Democrat. And during this time where, you know, as you mentioned, some of the Democrats kind of like left the party and caucused with Republicans, he was never one of those. Although his protege who replaced him in the state Senate did join the Republicans. And I talked to people who sort of saw him as kind of having one foot in kind of both camps a lot of time, where he was officially a Democrat, but at least seen as sort of friendly to the Republicans and to those breakaway Democrats.
Well, he's also just been the subject of many controversies, including backing a friend of his in the state Senate who was accused of, I think, slashing his girlfriend or his significant other. He also, as I mentioned, currently, there's a question as to, one, if he even lives in New York, and the properties that he rents out in New York City, the income from that seems to be entirely unaccounted for. And he has made up a variety of lies about who he is or what he's done, or that seem to be lies. You can't verify them, but one about him being a valedictorian that, you know, but or he should have been valedictorian, but he wasn't. I mean, these sound silly, but when you add all of them up, it paints a picture of kind of a shadowy, not so truthful politician who is of the political machine that, as we say, the left in New York has made great gains in its fight against.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he does. He's either had the most interesting life anyone has ever imagined, or there's some fudging going on. Because he often, when he's in front of a microphone, will tell some story that will leave people just wondering, like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, as you mentioned, he said he was had the best grades in his police academy class, highest GPA, but they gave the valedictorian award to somebody else. which is just like, why would they do that? I mean, it just seems like a weird thing to happen. He said that he, you know, as a police officer, he was off duty and he broke up an anti-Asian hate crime in the 90s, which was, again, like something he just sort of brought up at a debate. He's talked about, you know, providing airfare, bus fare for children who are caught up in sex trafficking. But he's never really talked about it until he was running for office, when he did talk about it. And so it's kind of hard to know much about the bio of the guy. He did appear to not live in New York City by many accounts. He had a townhouse in the Bed-Stuy neighborhood of Brooklyn, which he had said that he rented out to such a and got so much money from the rental income that he paid his son's way through college with that rental income. He never actually disclosed that income to the IRS. He said it was because he was doing repairs on the townhouse, but he never disclosed the repairs. He then also owned another apartment in another part of Brooklyn with a former partner, and he was using it as an official address for his campaign documents and other things up until last year. He said that he signed over the house, the apartment, to his former girlfriend in 2005, even though he was continuing to use it in 2020. And again, also never filed that with the IRS. So it's really hard to know. It's certainly like a colorful background and story. And it's hard to know what to make of all of this. It's hard to know what, you know, the actual authorities who have to keep an eye on these kind of things will make on all this once more of it comes to light.
Yeah, I mean, I we have a video of him that will eventually play after we are finished speaking, where he got his ear pierced other day as a part of a bet. But yeah, I mean, he's just incredibly colorful, and he's definitely going to bring us a lot of viral clips. So like, he won in poorer areas. I think it was like the South Brooklyn, or I mean, what were some of the areas, some of the Bronx, like more of the outer boroughs he had success in, which I guess, you know, runs counter to some of the narratives that progressives at least want to tell themselves, or what was the somewhat anomalous success of Ocasio-Cortez's campaign in New York 14, of areas that are lower income and majority minority. You know, she was a progressive candidate, but they voted for this, you know, tough on crime guy who seemed to, he ran a campaign, what was it, in the early 2000s about pull your pants up, or putting secret cameras in kids' bedrooms to see where they were hiding drugs. Like, he seemed to be appealing to older voters of color, maybe parents who wanted crime to improve in their area and spoke in this kind of way. But in terms of policy, certainly his tough on crime stance is not in keeping with, as we talk about, larger progressive movements in a city that is one of the most progressive in the country. Just how do you square those things? How do you characterize the candidacy within that context?
Yeah, it's a great question. So he won in Central Brooklyn, and he won in Southeast Queens, and really, you know, swamped the vote in that area. You know, I think in a lot of ways, I don't think we always appreciate this necessarily, but I think especially in these like urban political environments, like a mayor's race, I think identity concerns end up mattering almost as much as ideology. And that makes a lot of sense. Like, you know, for poor and traditionally dispossessed communities, they are going to want someone that looks like them, someone that comes from those neighborhoods into high office. I mean, that's quite an achievement. And so, you know, as he was sort of the most prominent African-American candidate running, and he was able to get, you know, the vast, vast majority of African-American support. But I don't know if like a more progressive Black candidate wouldn't have actually done better or just as well in those neighborhoods. He certainly made crime a big focus. And And also, I mean, but also talked about police reform and never sort of described those things as being really in competition with each other. And we'll have to see how that works. I mean, he's someone who's sort of spoken on the one hand, you know, he's kind of always is kind of a little bit all over the place, but he's someone who was suing to end stop and frisk, who, which is the, you know, the police practice here that kind of faded out under Mike, at the end of Mike Bloomberg's morality.
No, he was forced to by the courts, but yeah.
Forced by the courts, yeah. But he also, you know, he's also talked about like reinstituting it, and Adams has spoken favorably of it. He's talked about instituting this plainclothes anti-crime unit that was disbanded because they were involved in like too many kind of horrific incidents. So I think it's going to be hard to kind of square that circle, but he really did make crime a focus of his campaign. And, you know, he was backed by some very like reactionary forces in the city, including the New York Post. He was spoken favorably of on multiple occasions by Fox News, by Tucker Carlson,
by Rudy Giuliani,
Right. And if you'll recall, you know, there was these, you know, there was this, every shooting is horrific, obviously. There's like a random shooting in Times Square a few months ago, and he held a press conference immediately afterwards, and then held another press conference like a few hours after that, which is kind of making crime the salient issue of the election.
Yeah, and I just for comedy's sake, I'm just wondering if you could describe those ads that he did. Just speaks to who he is as a person. And, you know, this tough on crime thing, even though he described himself as a police reformer, he did, you know, try to reform within the system. But the dominant through line, if there is one, with this guy who seems to lie about everything, is tough on crime. And like those corny ads, which are bizarre.
Are you talking about the from earlier in his career?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I mean, so he started a Stop the SAG campaign when he was a state lawmaker, which was designed, it was like billboards in his district and I think all around the city, using obviously, you know, state money to get young men to pull their pants up. He then cut a I guess you call it a PSA. It ended up on YouTube of teaching parents how to search their kids' rooms for guns and drugs, which includes things like taking out the books and shaking them and like checking the back of a doll that may be on a bed and seeing if the child is hiding, you know, cocaine in the diaper of the doll or something. Yeah, it was, you know, they were really embarrassing to state lawmakers, to Democrats at the time, who just thought that they were just always kind of silly. And a lot of his initiatives that he's taken on as Brooklyn Borough president have been kind of similarly silly in a way, where it's about, he'll, you know, unveil a new contraption that's about teaching, you know, about how they're going to drown rats in a bucket of poison or something. I mean, all these things that are just, they seem sort of stunty in a way. And, you know, it's hard to know when he is in a position of sort of real responsibility, what will happen with all that kind of thing. Cause it's all very reactive, right? It's all very like somebody's in the news. I'm going to do a kind of like stunty thing to get into the news cycle, which is not really quite what the job of being mayor is.
Yeah. And in my experience, honestly, that kind of performative, you know, attempts to get in the news, it doesn't portend well for lawmaking or leadership. Mm-hmm. Again, I think about Trump or Cuomo or whatever mm-hmm. the case may be. Yeah. I'm curious, I know this is not New York City anymore, but just in terms of New York State, India Walton, how you see her victory in the primary in Buffalo in this context. She's a socialist and proudly so, and she won her primary in Buffalo, and that was, you know, one of the many successes by New York DSA, which has been more successful than other DSA chapters throughout the country. Not saying that other DSA chapters haven't done good work, but I guess curious about how you'd characterize that victory.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to sort of remember, one always has to remember that all of these races, like they take place in their own context, and you can then sort of overread them from what, you know, and try to like extrapolate about them. But like Eric Adams was running against seven other people, really, right? And so like he beat them. And Dear Walton was running against a longtime mayor of Buffalo, who had sort of, you know, popularity had sunk. I think he had barely won re-election the last time. And they were able to kind of fill the vacuum there, DSA and other sort of left-leaning outfits, in a very low turnout primary context. And so she won. You know, what that sort of means for like really anything beyond the context of that election, I think it can be a little hard to say.
Right. And so, I mean, lastly, I think that's kind of the same analysis we can bring to the, so now I feel like I sound hypocritical. I do think Ocasio-Cortez's race was more indicative of a national movement than, you know, Eric Adams, or even Walton's win, not taking away from that in terms of leftist, you know, power and how that, what that meant. But I mean, how do we then say at the same time that Eric Adams is wrong to say that he's the new face of the Democratic Party, based on his very specific victory here in New York against, you know, AOC endorsed Maya Wiley at the 11th hour. There was really no competent leftist candidate or organizing effort behind any of them. When Scott Stringer, when those allegations, which have now been kind of have fallen apart, they derailed his campaign significantly. And there was it's just odd. There was no infrastructure in the city to combat a guy like Adams.
Yeah, I mean, right. Again, it's sort of like the specific context of the race. I mean, I think had Ocasio-Cortez run for mayor, I think she probably would have won, or she would have done very well. I think had Jomani Williams, who's another you know, left-leaning city politician, he's elected citywide public advocate, I think he could have possibly run. I mean, Eric Adams, the day after the election, said, I'm the you know, face of a new Democratic Party, or the new face of the Democratic Party, or he would like to be that, obviously. I mean, everybody sort of thinks their election heralds the dawn of a new age. I mean, you know, in AOC's congressional run, it was like, she wasn't alone. And it was kind of surrounded by all of this other stuff happening that I think really you could make the case that it was. And in Adams's case, I mean, you know, he was endorsed by almost every major labor union in the city. He was endorsed by a lot of elected officials, a lot of political clubs. Mayor Bill de Blasio was quietly pulling strings behind him. He raised a ton of money from, you know, real estate interests. And he won by a single point against a candidate, Catherine Garcia, who had none of that, who had never run for office before, who had almost no campaign staff, who had no endorsements other than from newspaper editorial boards, very limited money, very inexperienced campaigner. Like, she was the city sanitation commissioner last year. So, you know, like, congrats to Eric Adams. He very smartly, like, secured his base and rode that to victory. But, like, let's not pretend that this is a huge mandate by any means. I mean, the guy won by a single point when, you know, two other left-leaning candidates' campaigns collapsed for various reasons.
Very lastly, do you see this Republican challenger against him in the general going anywhere? We talk about Mayor Eric Adams, or like, does he even make it there? I'm a little worried that some of these investigations into his, if there are any investigations launched into him not paying taxes on some of these properties, who knows where that goes. But
yeah, I mean, so, you know, I don't know how well, you know, your audience is familiar with Curtis Sliwa, the Republican running, but I can safely say he's a clown. I mean, he's a total clown. He's a guardian. It's this group called a Guardian Angel who, like, he wears this red beret and they were supposed to patrol the subways in the 1980s and 90s. he lives in a studio with 15 cats. He's like a guy who, you know, is on, like, he's kind of like a shock jock radio drive time guy. I agree with you. These issues that have come up about Adams, taxes, and residents are to me, a huge flashing red light. I don't see how we ever get around them. I don't know when all that is brought to bear, but boy, that is something he will have to sort out if he is going to ever be mayor of New York City.
Well, David Friedlander, thank you so much for talking to us today and giving us the colorful details of New York City politicians like Eric Adams. It was very helpful. And of course, talking about your book, The AOC Generation, How Millennials Are Seizing Power and Rewriting the Rules of American Politics. Thank you so much, David, for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be talking a little bit more about Haiti. Be right back. So we're getting more information, but still not a ton, about the assassination of Haitian President Moïse, which happened not yesterday, but I believe in the dead of night leading up to yesterday, which has sent shockwaves throughout the country, understandably so. And it's also particularly relevant when looking at U.S. empire, because U.S. foreign policy with Haiti has been long. It's been bloody. It's been colored by fears of black liberation, and of course, U.S. imperialism and economic dominance. We've been interfering with Haiti throughout its country's history, and of course, it's always about exerting U.S. hegemony and global dominance at all costs, particularly for our economic interests. As I say, we had a journalist, Jeremy Scahill, on a few months ago or weeks ago. He dubbed Joe Biden the empire politician. And that's evident in this 1994 clip. Is that what year this is? 90s clip at the very least, of Biden talking about Haiti within the context of U.S. interests. I think this is relevant just given how the U.S. is going to respond to this power vacuum in Haiti. And was there any United States involvement despite the U.S. propping up Moïse for many years, and other members of the bourgeoisie. Let's take a listen, though, to Biden some years ago talking about Haiti.
Y'all went into Grenada for 40, 170, not 500 medical students. And here there are thousands of blacks being persecuted, killed, death squads, and you're not doing anything. Clearly, Haiti is no more or less in the interest of the United States than Grenada. So what you have, for example, a leading editor of a paper in the Delaware Valley asked their reporters to come down and talk to me and said, why is Biden so concerned about Bosnia and not about Haiti? Is it because blacks are involved in Haiti? Blacks are what at stake in Haiti, and in Bosnia they are European whites. There is that notion abroad in the Congress, in the country. It's not substantially different than when Lech Walesa came along and all the polls in the state of Delaware and the United States of America focused, or when Israel is in trouble and the American Jewish community and those who believe strongly in Israel focus. Or you can list throughout our history circumstances where our multi-ethnic community looks to things happening in a constituency that they are from, represent, or feel having a stake in. So if Haiti, a god-awful thing to say, if Haiti just quietly sunk into the Caribbean or rose up 300 feet, it wouldn't matter a whole lot in terms of our interest.
But doesn't the world and...
Well, so that clip was circulating about Haiti falling into the sea, and a lot of people who are supporters of Joe Biden said that it was taken out of context, but I'm not sure contextualizing it with how we view nations and helping them as purely an effort to exert U.S. hegemony. I'm not sure how much that makes a difference, Matt.
I want to make sure. Yeah, the idea that Israel and Bosnia are, we're only interested in those countries because, like, people on the ground here have organized it on a, along ethnic lines to make us. No, those are, those have imperial significance for us. And also, like, the idea that we've not been interested in what Haiti's been doing, we've not been interested in helping them. We've been interested in, like, say, 1995 when the IMF was telling them to privatize major national industries, and when Bill Clinton was telling them to lower sugar and rice tariffs so that those agriculture workers can go instead work in textile factories. So we do care about Haiti, as a place to exploit and beat down.
Yes, and also, as you know, we talked about, some sort of representative in the region that is going to prop up, say, U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, where the United States was gleeful that Moïse, who has now passed, was fully behind them in propping up Guaido as the leader of Venezuela, which was not true. And you mentioned Bill Clinton there. I mean, Haiti and the relationship with Bill Clinton after his presidency, too, with the Clinton Foundation, in the way that they tried to reimagine Haiti after the devastating earthquake that really just ravaged the country. It was just so indicative of the neoliberal project, remaking it in a way that was profitable to the Clinton orbit, which he did as president and he did after president. And then, you know, another point to make too about Moïse and our relationship with Haiti is that it's spans administrations. You had Obama upholding Moïse, who really was a member of industry. He made his money crookedly with fruit exports, I believe. And then when Obama left, Trump upheld him as well. And Biden seemingly had, we don't know of any U.S. involvement in this, but if he was assassinated with United States involvement, it was just because he became so problematic that the United States could no longer support him because he was becoming more of a liability for the neoliberal project than an asset anymore, because there were so many protests against him.
Yeah, ultimately, and if you could mute while I'm talking. Ultimately, like, Biden mentions death squads in that old clip, right? And Moïse has been using and directing death squads. And when you get involved in that sort of business, it sometimes doesn't end well with those, when you make deals with those kind of folks. I mean, we're not sure exactly what happened, but I'm just saying, like, this has been a long-term problem, and America was supporting people who let that problem fester.
Yeah, it's funny that Biden mentions death squads in that context, as if the United States isn't instrumental to the propagation of death squads internationally. But that is our show today. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. That's what I say to the guests. But you're all guests, audience. Thank you so much for watching. We will see you tomorrow. Unless you're hanging out with us a little bit longer, we are going to head into the fun half. We're going to have a lot of fun times in the fun half. Did I say fun? Matt, what is happening on Left Reckoning? And damn, I'm like, now that we're back in studio, I guess, I'll mute when you're talking, so it doesn't pick up.
Yeah, it's a weird echo. But last night, Austin Gonzalez of Machete Mate came to talk about some amazing work he's been doing with DSA folks, going to both Peru and Venezuela on democracy outreach missions. We had a great talk about particularly the political dynamics in Peru and the rewriting of a Fujimori constitution, I would say, is a good example of things that can be done when you really get the left to take over power, per our interview today. So check out that last night, and it's going to be on Wednesdays at 8 Eastern from now on. Left Reckoning, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get our post game where we talk about Donnie Deutsch and some other, you know, people like that.
And don't forget to check out the Noma Key Show. She has new hours, which I'm forgetting at this current juncture. And we have Brandon Sutton here to plug Discourse. Where is he? There's Brandon. Hey, Brandon.
Hey, Brandon. I don't know if he can hear us.
Brandon. All right. Well, we got Binder coming up, though, so he can plug Doom.
Hey, Binder, you there?
I am now here. Hello, everybody. How are you all doing today?
We're doing lovely. How about yourself, and how about Doomed?
Oh, Doomed is doing great. Tonight at youtube.com/MattBinder at around 9 p.m. Eastern time. Well, I don't know why I said around. At 9 p.m. Eastern time. I guess I usually do start a little bit late. But be there at 9 p.m. Eastern time. I will have on Michael Edison Hayden of Southern Poverty Law Center. And we will be talking about his latest report on Twitter's ties to various far-right figures. The report really goes into detail specifically about Jack Dorsey, Twitter CEO, and the various connections he has to figures on the right. And, you know, why so many figures on the far right, some who have been banned on other social media platforms, are not only still on Twitter, which is one decision, but are also still verified figures on Twitter, which is another completely bizarre decision. That's tonight, youtube.com/MattBinder at 9 p.m. Eastern time. Subscribe now while you're right here on YouTube, so you don't, if you're watching live on the live stream, so you don't miss out.
Yes, do that. And Brandon, what's happening over on the Discourse?
Hello. Today, you know, I think we're going to have a series of interviews or a series of podcasts placed onto our Discourse by John with his interview with a Black Left AF on Twitter. And we're also going to have another episode for patrons coming up by, you know, end of today, tomorrow. We took the 4th of July off. We're very patriotic over in the Discourse. A lot of patriots in, you know, in our ranks.
Did you partake in the Claire McCaskill tradition of watching January 6th footage?
Oh, you know, I did not, you know. Instead, I just like stood for about 12 hours saluting a flag until my feet started to bleed, until you know, passed out from dehydration, like all good Americans should.
Yes. Well, I mean, if you didn't do it in the Walmart, I don't really give a shit. So anyway, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Binder, can you please do the phones today? Bye.
Oh, yeah, sure. No problem.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back. Back, back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Can we bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on. Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday. My birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.